846-4CA.
12 minutes to 11 here on 846-4CA. Good morning. We're going to continue this debate. We just had Terry James talking about this issue of accommodating population growth over the next 5, 10, however many years, right through to 2050 and beyond. We've been having this debate all week. It's been absolutely fantastic and very, very necessary, that's for sure. Someone I was keen to have a chat to who doesn't mind sharing his opinion on occasion, it's Pat Flanagan. Pat is a retired engineer, former director of Flanagan Consulting Group, obviously been involved with developing the city over many, many years indeed. He joins us now. Good morning, Pat.
G'day,
Gav. Thanks for being with us. Now, Mr. Flanagan, are you part of this 2050 growth strategy discussions that council's having at the moment?
Oh, I'm participating in it. I'm on a professional reference group for council, but I also attended the forum they had recently. So, I'm familiar with it.
And is it good to see, from your point of view, council's at least grappling with this issue?
Oh, absolutely. I was banging the drum for some really strategic planning and long-term view for a number of years, as you know.
I was interested to hear, we had a couple of chats during the week about, the lack of greenfield sites going forward. James McPeak, a town planner, estimates that there might only be 5 to 10 years worth of, really significant greenfield development sites left in the Cairns Regional Council footprint. We keep sending people further south. And I dared to raise the issue of the cane fields on the northern beaches. Is that an area, despite the floodplain that it is that an area that we should, consider, relook at, think about building on? You obviously were involved with the Aquis development that was going to be in cane fields there, I think at Yorkies. Pat, is it ever possible to develop a residential land and homes on some of those cane fields on the northern beaches?
Not on any significant size. I mean, even though people think Aquis was a huge development, the reality is, even on its site, it was only a 40 hectare footprint in a 470 hectare site.
Right.
And in the context of the Delta, it was a very, very small proportion of the Delta. The key to developing on a floodplain is that whatever you do to raise whatever development you want to be above flood immunity level or to be flood safe, whatever, when you fill, you will have impacts around the fill. The velocity will go up and the height of the flood will go up.
Yes.
You've got to have a big enough piece of land so that those impacts are constrained within your property.
Yeah, boundaries. Right. Yes.
So that means you've got to have a relatively small footprint in a relatively large piece of land. Mm. So the issue is that you've got to own a lot of land and you're not going to get much yield out of it.
Yes, right.
So all of the uses on the Delta in the long term will be flood-tolerant uses. Now, what are flood-tolerant uses? Mm. Flood-tolerant uses are agriculture and sand mining. And what's there now? Agriculture and sand mining.
Yes.
Because it's a Delta. I mean, it's subject to flooding. There's an 80 lot subdivision on the Delta, which was the original township of Smithfield. It's still there, but you can't develop it because it goes underwater every year. So it's a physical constraint because of what it is. If it didn't have those constraints, it would have been developed 100 years
ago.
Yes,
exactly.
One of the reasons it's not developed is because it's not developable.
Yep. All right, so that's off the table. What else can we do, Pat, to accommodate this population growth?
Well, I've always said that if we're going to double our population, you've got two options, is to double the footprint or double the density. The reality will be it'll be a combination of both. I don't see a great big opportunity to expand the footprint because we've basically developed all of the areas that aren't flood prone.
Yes.
With the exception of Mount Peter, which is flagged for future development. But that's only going to accept a relatively small proportion, or probably 40% of the projected population growth. So it's going to be an increase in density. Now, before everyone throws their hands in the air and says, oh, high-rise buildings everywhere, it won't necessarily be high-rise buildings. You can actually do it with a whole series of urbanised nodes. So density around nodes,
yep,
around shopping centres and transport stations. So not everyone has to live in a unit, but the proportion of people living in units will increase. And that's been happening anyway. You know, that's the trend. People, the newer generations these days, don't really want the 800 square metre lot and picket fence model that we all desired in the 50s and 60s. So now people are used to urban living, and urbanised living rather than suburban living is just the way communities are trending anyway.
Well, downsizes as well, Pat. Downsizes as well increasingly love apartment living.
Exactly. I mean, rather than building suburbs of 3- and 4-bedroom housing, maybe it's a matter of recycling the existing 3- and 4-bedroom housing to encourage people that are, there's a lot of spare bedrooms in the town, people that have housing which is of greater capacity than what they need. Maybe they, you know, there should be an encouragement for them to downsize and to open up the opportunity for the larger house for people who are at that stage of their lifestyle, their family formation and family growth. And those houses tend to be in close proximities to schools and things already.
Yes, exactly.
So it's a matter of, and it sounds like the cold hand of state control, but it's not. You can set up incentives to make sure that people efficiently use the housing stock. But it takes a fair bit of thought and forethought, and you know, unfortunately, our property culture in Australia, particularly encouraged over the last 20 years, with significant taxation benefits to the family home and to second home buyers, means that the price of housing's gone up, and the ability to reactivate some of that housing is fairly limited. So I think there's policy opportunities at federal government level and at state government level which could encourage a better use of our existing housing stock and the creation of housing stock in the future, which will meet housing needs.
And, of course, the issue of the business case and the rising cost of construction that is hindering apartment development, that's another topic. I guess, finally, Pat, before we get to the 11 o'clock news, I mean, should we be concerned and worried about this lack of housing and accommodation for our city going forward?
Look,
it's coming to a pointy end, isn't it, surely?
Yeah, but markets respond. I mean, you know, the sky was falling 30 years ago when people were thinking about going south of Bayview, you know. I mean,
yes.
People, the market will respond, the community will respond. As the demand for units goes up, the efficiency of unit production will go up. I do think there needs policy intervention at all levels of government, particularly in the taxation policy, to change the priority away from investors into first home buyers, or at least people to be able to get on the rung earlier. I'd hate to be a young person today trying to get into the housing market.
Yes.
When I bought my first house, the house was about twice my salary. These days it's about 10 times the person's
salary.
Yeah,
that's right.
So it's extremely difficult. They load themselves up with very high long-term debt. So it becomes a bit of a burden. And I just think, you know, that's a problem.
Yeah, very well said. Very interesting as well. Pat Flanagan, thanks, mate, for your time on the talk show this morning.
Good on you, Gav. Cheers, mate.
That's Pat Flanagan. He's a retired engineer, but of course has been so involved with all kinds of development over many, many years here in our city. So absolutely fantastic to get Pat's insights.